It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Well, welcome to another episode of Alaska Tracks, where we listen to oral history interviews with veteran Alaskan outdoorsmen and women. This project began in 1997 and is still ongoing. Most of the interviews were recorded between 2000 and 2010. In today's episode, we will be hearing from Lyle Garner, who spent his later years on the Kenai Peninsula. In his younger days, Lyle traveled the state wherever work and adventure led him. Lyle was a consummate outdoorsman, successful at everything he tried. In this first segment, Lyle tells when and how he came to Alaska.
I was born in eastern Oregon, Pendleton area, and I liked hunting and fishing, and that's what I'd done since I was a little guy and raised with my family, so I decided Alaska was home for me. And I came here, stayed a short while, went back out, then came back in a short while and stayed ever since. I've been from one end of this state to the other, Ketchikan to Point Barrow, and on further north to where the Colville hits the Beaufort Sea, just inside of it in the Arctic Ocean. And I fished the Teeksig, Puck Lakes, and Wolf Creek, and the Colville for whitefish. When I was there, it was in 1949 and 50, and there was caribou wherever you look, just going every which way. So many bugs they couldn't stop, they'd have to run all the time. And me too.
In this next segment, Garner talks about some of the cabins he used on his adventures over the years.
Because I always left these cabins with more in them than when I went there, and I left more wood, and I left more kindling, and the water bucket would be clean and upside the way it's supposed to be, and the place you could eat off the floor when you leave the cabin. And the kindling right behind the stove, and one in the stove all laid to put a match to. Yeah. And then people love you for that. And a lamp full of coal. And that's what gets you return trips. Yeah, you don't leave a bunch of stuff in the sink, leave a mess. That's not the way it's done. That's the old time Alaskans. And sometimes I'd come into one of my cabins and I'd leave a bunch of beans there that we didn't eat. Their beans would be gone and canned peas would be there. Next time you got canned corn, you never know what's going to be there when you get back. Somebody's got too much corn, they'll trade it for some beans or peas, you know. Whatever, you know, that's the way it is in the woods. But you don't leave your doors locked. If you lock your doors and a guy is hurting, all you're going to get out of it is a broken window or a broken door. You know, if you leave the door open on a latch key, the guy usually treats you pretty good. So I didn't know what a lock was in the woods. But on Kodiak, I built my own cabins. I run a fishing boat 25 years out of there. We had our regular trapping cabins we built, log cabins. But while we were building them, we camped under a tent, and you could hear the bears going by at night, whooping, you know. We had some run-ins with them. In them times, there was lots of bears.
Lyle had tons of experience as a trapper. In this next segment, he tells a few stories and relates some of the knowledge he gained over the years.
If you were on foot, how would you get your trapping gear in?
Pack on your back, packboard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes pretty heavy packs. Three of us worked together.
And would you stash them back?
Oh, yeah. No, you left them on the trap line. Hang them. Mm-hmm. You hang all your traps. But we used to snares an awful lot. Lots of beaver on Kodiak District because Fognak was loaded. That's where my trap line was. We trapped that for years in there. I had a long trap line through there, all the way down Discover Bay and Paranosa, clear back to Red Peak and across to Paul's Bay, all through there. We had 496 beavers our best year. That was the most that anybody ever took out of there. Three of us worked.
Kodiak's got a reputation of being a real wet climate.
Yeah.
So would it be a real challenge to get those hides dry? And
we built a cabin right off, 15 by 17 on one end and one on the other. Then we worked in between, and the fishing game let me use some of their cabin. Mac McKinley would let me use any cabin on Fognak at the time. And so we used fishing game cabins, the summer cabins, a lot.
And having that access to those cabins kept your furs dry.
Oh, well, it helped. We keep them mostly in the main cabin where we had heat all the time. One person would be up taking care of fur all the time. two on the line, three out of three of us.
Do you care to tell us who your partners were?
Yeah, Big Bill Elliott was one of them, and Cumlander was one of them, and Dave Lindbergh was one of them, and Ronnie Hogan, one of them. They were all partners at one time or another. We had another guy, John Murray. He come up in 65, and a bear killed him. Yeah, they found his head 20 feet away from his body, and one shell out of the gun. So many people think you shoot two, three, four times at a bear, but if you get the second shot, you're pretty lucky. A bear, when he's coming for you from a close-up, two shots is not likely. If the first one got it count.
Now, were you on snowshoes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I never much went for dogs. Dogs is a lot of work. I can snowshoe about as far as I can carry the fur for them, and I take a little toboggan sled behind and tie it to my belt, throw the fur on it. And I can go about any place I can go with a dog team. I'll tell you something else, them snow machines don't catch beaver either. If you get anyways near a beaver house, beaver won't come out for much as a month after you park a snow machine close by.
So you think just the noise of the snow machine?
Oh, yeah. I had some people I trapped with. They trapped a valley there, about 15 houses. They didn't get no beaver, and they told me all of them's out of there. There ain't no beaver in there. So I didn't, just leave it alone. So we left it about 6 weeks, and I slipped back in there and opened those houses up nice and quiet on snowshoes. And the first night I took 6 beaver out on one end and 2 out on the other, so I had 8 of them for one night. That's a lot of beaver for one night. When I come back in, those guys was convinced that snow machines wasn't the way to go. You gotta stop a quarter mile from them if you snow machine them. They're pretty shy, beaver. Mm-hmm. That's the only time I ever seen it, too. They wouldn't come out. I set a big house on Fog Neck one time, a big house. I set 5 snares, I believe, in runways. I run it every day that I went by. That's maybe twice a week. Every time I went by there, I'd run that house. Never had a snare disturbed. And after about 5 weeks, I went by one day and there's one in every snare. But they knew something was wrong, but they didn't come out. But I starved them out. They always got feed that they can get from the house too, you know. And a beaver's got a place where he takes all of his used stuff out and brings his new in up here. He goes out to get feeds where you catch him. If you set it where he takes it out, all you catch is a dead eaten piece of wood with no bark on it. That's all you catch if you put it the wrong way. Always.
When you were trapping any of these places, whether it was up in the Yentna or out on Kodiak, is there a lot of competition right next door, or would you have it pretty much to yourself?
No, we didn't have nothing like that. When you set a trap line out, people would, wherever you got to, they may trap the other way from there, but I never had people run right down my line except one time. One guy set one in my line, and I sprung his trap and hung it in a tree, and he picked it up and didn't do it anymore. I don't think he knew I was there. And then I had a guy tell me that he was going to set some otter traps on one of my lines, and he got his hand in one of my otter traps. He couldn't see it. He said, "You set them better covered than I do." And that was Sammy Nelson. He's native from there. Mm-hmm. He said, you really cover them. If an otter's been in a trap, if he can see any part of the outline of it, he's not going to go back into it. You get the big ones that way, the ones that's trap shy. That's the big boys.
Did you ever buy or sell any of your trap lines?
No. I trapped, the Yentna belonged to a fellow by the name of Les Ness, and me and him and another guy, Les Tuttle, trapped that. Forget what year that was. That's a long time ago. But we trapped it, and there was a lot of marten, quite a few lynx, and lots of beaver. Beaver everywhere.
How about snow conditions? You get a lot of snow up there?
Yeah, quite a lot. You get a lot of ice if you don't. Some years the snow would come late. You may go down as much in some places as 6 feet in ice. You're using a double-bitted axe to chop ice, a heavy one, 5.5 pound. You try to start a hole 12, 14 feet long, 4 feet wide, maybe 3.5, chop it, keep getting closer down, make a little platform, stand down there and cut. When you first get a little bit of water, then you get up on top and you use a pole with an ice chisel on it to cut the bottom out. It doesn't take an awful long time. 2 people, one guy do the chopping, the other guy do the shoveling, maybe 15. An hour. One time I cut, I think it was 9 dry holes before I hit the channel. That made me a little disgusted. Well, it looked like it was all good. Couldn't find the channel, and I finally found the channel. It was froze down about 5 foot of ice. And it looked like the channel ran right straight out of the house, but it didn't. It ran right along the close up and then out, and nothing right in front.
Were you down to your t-shirt by the time you finally got
it? Well, no, a little cold for that. In the interior there, when we trapped up above Glen Allen, toward the copper, and I'll tell you now, it gets 75 below, and you don't go out when it's past 50. Fur don't travel after 50, it goes under the snow and the ice anyway. We used to travel 40 though, 45. Get a chair by the door, put one foot on it, get your parka all ready, step up on it real fast about 15 times, then jerk it open and run like hell the first 100 yards, and then start walking as fast as you can. You know, get the circulation going. You open that door, a whole house full of smoke, you know, from the cold. I don't like that cold country. I don't see no reason to trap in country that cold.
How far would you walk in the course of the day?
Any place upwards of 15 miles from that to 30. Sometimes we'd have, when we get in, 200 pounds, 50, 60, but always more than 50 on any of the longer runs, because you don't get everything skinned. I've had 4 beavers on my pack at once, but I was able to do it in them days. I couldn't carry one now. And Big Bill Elliott, the guy that trapped with me the most, was 6'4 and weighed 240, and he wasn't an ounce of fat on him, and he could carry a pretty good load. Lots of planes would land at our place and eat sourdoughs with us. They said this is the only good dinner they had all day. They'd have breakfast in the morning, sourdoughs and pancakes, sometimes beaver liver or venison, whatever. Lots of deer there. Deer everywhere. Well, marten trapping is the easiest of all trapping. If you're where they're at, you can't miss. If you know anything at all about them, you just stick a pole up against a tree and level off the top of it and stick a trap on it. Hang a bird wing up there and put a little smoke fish on the bottom of the tree so that you can smell it. You come up and go right up the pole into the trap. You don't put no cover on it or nothing. Put his foot in, and they used to be worth more money than most anything. They were up to $140 in the late 30s. Foxes were worth a lot then. Then they got nothing.
What was a good harvest for a year?
Marten, the most I think that I've ever caught in one year, is probably around 70, and maybe 130 otter, 300 plus beaver, and 300 plus fox on Kodiak, because they were just thick, but they weren't worth nothing. And marten is on Kodiak too. They planted them in 1937, and they thought they had all died off. When I first started trapping over there, Fish and Game didn't know they were there. I told them a lot of marten, why don't you open season? Oh, there's no marten, you're seeing fox traps. I said, hey, they're not fox traps. I've trapped all my life. What are you trying to tell me here? Well, bring us one in. So I brought them one in. And then they got excited. So then they opened season on them. I was getting 60, 70, 75 marten a year. Otter was a big catch because that's a lot of money. Otters bring good. Where we trap, we're in Discover Bay, and they call it the Chewyak otter. Is the most valuable otter anywhere in the world. Otters come up ever so far, play and slide and raise a lot of cane around. They call them an otter come up. You set where they come in and out. You don't set where they go down, but where they come up, because if they're going down, they got their feet up and you don't get nothing but hair. So
heard that once they're in a trap, they're hard to hold.
No, not an otter. A beaver's much harder to hold than an otter. If you get a foot, an otter is going to stay there with a 3 or a 4 double spring. But a beaver with a number 3 will, if he's a good-sized beaver, will just leave dodge. All you got's a sprung trap because he slammed out of it. Beaver's got a lot more weight and more power. We trapped the Yentna, and that was wolverine country. Caught a lot of wolverine there. I got 16 one year in there.
Wow.
Well, you don't want wolverines, but you got to keep them out of your beaver. They're a real beaver eater, you know. And if you got a beaver and it gets up where they can get to it, they'll even tear the ice out from around to get a beaver out. So you make a wolverine set where you got a beaver set sometimes. If you don't want the wolverine, at that time I was only getting $12 for a wolverine. I needed him like a hole in the head. But I wanted to keep the beaver I got. But by the same token, otter tear them up too. So we try to keep the land otter and the wolverine out of our beaver country when we can. But wolverines will come in when you get to trapping beaver. Then you have bear trouble sometimes. The bears like to tear your trap line up once in a while, not too much.
Welcome back to Alaska Tracks. Today's guest is Lyle Garner. Garner remembers back when the Anchorage Fur Rondy was little more than a gathering of trappers who came to town to sell their furs. None of the fancy events that were added over the years. Apparently, it was a wild time back then, too.
Who would you sell your furs to? Do you have somebody local, or do you send them to the lower 48, or?
Well, on Fog Neck, I sold an awful lot of mine to the people, enough to make a coat. Sold an awful lot of them that way. Of course, I had to ship some, and I had to sell some over in Anchorage here. So mostly to Basili and a couple of other buyers, because they process them. And Green, he sent them out and then bring them back and sell an awful lot to the natives. And he don't want to pay much at that time. He That's the old man. He didn't pay enough to suit me anyway. And then we had the rendezvous in Anchorage. The rendezvous, what I'm talking about, ain't the rendezvous you're talking about now. We all come in March, the first part of March, because the last day of February is the end of the season. First part of March, you go in, and on 4th Avenue, they had what they call the old federal building. In the back, that was from this territory. The back of it was a jail, in the front of it, all the state offices, and on the left side back was the game commission. And the game commission was a big room. We'd bring all of our furs in there and pile them on the floor. The game commission go through and tag what they wanted to tag. And the buyers would walk through and turn this over. They bid so much on lynx, so much on wolverine, so much on beaver. They'd make you a bid. And you look it over, all your bids. Whoever bid the most on the lynx got the lynx. Whoever bid the most on the beaver got the beaver. We didn't sell them all to one guy. And that was called a rendezvous. It lasted a while. There would be 20 trappers in there at once, however many come in at one time. And they had them piled all over it. You just have a spot, and you just pile them out right on the floor. And the buyers went circulated through there, like, back and forth. Well, that was federal then. And they sell them eagle feet, they're on the bone on a wolf's leg, too. Mm. A coyote, wolf, and a one-year wolverine's had a bounty.
Maybe snuck down and had a beverage or two after all the sales took place?
A whole lot of beverages. The town was full of beverages. Bob Hope come through one year. He's riding in a open-top limousine, talking to everybody up and down the street. 4th Avenue was about the street 10 days. We all lived between 8th and 9th in little log cabins with a pitcher pumping the sink, you know, for water. Old Bob Hope says, geez, there were just solid bars, you know. Nothing else but bars about in a restaurant or two. He said, gee, this 4th Avenue is the longest bar in the world. That was a wild place. Everybody had a gun on their hip right near it. But there was everything here. It was the wildest town you'll ever imagine. There's one bar had a big sign above the door, the alibi. You could go in and you could see just about anything you wasn't looking for. Fights, out in the streets, fights. I was fighting a dude one time in Fairbanks in front of the old shanty, and he was a big man. We both were trained. We were just about an even match, but he was a big dude. I weighed 200 and him maybe 220. We'd been fighting for a while, and some woman called the police, and here come the U.S. Marshal with a deputy. And he drove up, and he was sitting in the car. And she ran over and said, well, aren't you going to stop it? And he says, hell no, I'm going to watch it. It's a good fight. I never will forget that. I'm hoping he'll stop it, you know. And pretty soon, this big dude I'm fighting with looked at me. He says, are you tired of this? And I said, yeah, me too. Let's go get drunk together. So we took off and went and got drunk together, you know. That's how it was. Nobody mad at each other. Just settle your differences, you know.
During his time on Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula, Garner had lots of experience with big bears. He learned a lot about their behavior, some of which he shares with us in this next segment.
Back in the 50s, we dug clams commercially on Swickshack Beach on the Alaska Peninsula, and there's about 40 miles of it from Cape Douglas all the way down to Big River. Swickshack is the main beach, and we had cabins there, and everybody built their own shacks up and down it, you know, because whoever the best clams was, they built a place to stay. Well, we built what we called a crib house. You just lay two logs this way, two this way, back and forth, and it's just full of bears there. We went up about 4 foot, then put some across there and put Biz Queen over the top of that and to keep the rain out, and a crawl hole so a bear can't get in, and we go inside of there and sleep at night because we wanted to sleep without having a bear snorting on us. Carry the shotgun on the beach when we was digging clams. Had a guy called Little Ray DeMantoff. He was a little fella. He crawled out of that crawl hole to go to the bathroom about 3 or 4 in the morning, and it was still just a little dark. And he walked over to the edge, and a bear walked up behind him and stuck its head between his legs, right at his knees, and went brrr, right up him. right up and raised him off the ground. He let the worst scream I ever heard out and jumped over the top of that 4 foot and come down through the Viz Queen and landed right on me. There was sand and snot all over his leg where that bear's nose come up there. Slobbers and all that. Boy, he shook for some while.
The bear was apparently just curious.
It didn't bite him or hurt him. I don't know why it done that. He didn't either, but it excited him somewhat. Then the Park Service had a tent, and they wanted to take everybody's guns. And I told them, not mine. You take everybody else's. And they took almost everybody's. They had this a tin shack he built, the Park Service guy, right on the edge of the beach. And he had all his stuff in it.
And why did they want to take the guns?
Well, they didn't want us to shoot no bear. They said it's more dangerous. That's little they knew. They're college kids. What do they know about it? Nothing. So here comes his two-wheeler wide open after a while, and he come to my place because I'm the only one with a gun. He says, come and help me. There's a bear tearing my shack down. I told him, no. You go talk to that bear and tell him he can't do that. I wouldn't help him a bit. It just scattered his stuff all over the beach. Teach him a lesson, you know. Come up here, and he thought bears, if you said hello, they was going to just walk on, you know. Well, a bear don't look at it that way. When you got a bear, you'd either be a good one or a bad one. I had what I called Granddad. He was an old man bear, big fella. And he followed me for 10, 12 years on the Fog Neck line. You could see him quite often. He'd be back behind. When I skin a beaver, put a beaver's hide in my pack, you go back there 30 minutes after you walked away and there ain't no beaver, but lots of big bear tracks. Follow me all winter long. See, bear don't stay in all winter, you know. And an old bear sometimes don't even go in, particularly if he ain't ate enough. He lived off me and he wouldn't never take nothing out of my cache or nothing out of my trap. He was an easy one to get along with. Last year I trapped, he was still there. I didn't have to get rid of him, which was good. Throw a fox carcass out and he's gone in no time. He was good that way. Good to have around. Oh, yeah, there's one other thing I can tell you about, kind of comical, you might want to hear. This fish and game guy at Creek Watchman, he was in Discoverer Bay on Fog Neck. Oh, this is quite a few years back. Where the salt water is, he had himself a toilet made, two tubifores between two trees, 30, 40 feet from his cabin, but the tide come up there and kept it clean. He left his 375 that the Fish and Game gives you in the cabin and brought himself some funny books. And he was sitting up there reading a funny book. Well, the bears go right down the beach, and this is close to the river. And he's brand new at the business. He's a college kid. So he's reading a funny paper, and he said he looked over it, and the bear was reading the other side. I said, why'd you do it? He said, what do you think I done? I just sat there and stared at him till he left. I got a kick out of that. He's yelling at me before I got all the way up to the cabin to call the plane. I want out of here. You know, he was really hollering to get out of there. That bear didn't do a thing to him, though. Just looked at him. So many people think you shoot 2, 3, 4 times at a bear, but if you get the second shot, you're pretty lucky. A bear, when he's coming for you from a close-up, you 2 shots is not likely. It's the first one got it count. I taught one of my boys that, Dave Lindberg. I taught him how to take care of a bear situation with a shotgun. See, we use shotguns almost invariably. I taught him to wait till his feet hit right the last jump before he's on you, and to let him have it, and go sideways. And he didn't go sideways, and it rolled over and broke his leg. But he survived. That's the main thing. He told me he'd been dead. I didn't teach him. It would have got him all right.
And the shotgun kills him, or just
No, it kills him. Even number 4 bird shot from 10 feet will take the top of a bear's head right off. They're pretty deadly, a shotgun. Mm-hmm. Much more so. It's easier. They point faster than a rifle, and they're more deadly. If you're using sabot slugs, they'll kill anything there is.
Lyle loved the lifestyle of a trapper and fisherman. You can hear it in his voice as he shares his memories.
You can make a living doing what you want to do. You know, that takes a certain breed of cat to work his whole life for one guy and come home at night and do the same thing over and over and over. I could never do that. I want to see a bear in my trail here and there and have a rough ride on the ocean, not all of them flat. A little adrenaline shaking up for you. It's life's too humdrum. Couldn't make it. Adrenaline is part of your life. And the more of it you get into, the more you like it. We out there in the ocean sometimes where a man in his right mind would be wishing some chopper would come along and get him off. But we usually get back. Sometimes I wished I wasn't there. If I started tomorrow to do something for 30 years, it'd be right back where I started. Do it all over again, yeah. All I got now is memories. And the fishing there is fabulous. Where you have to fish the inlet here for halibut over there, you can play around right uptown and catch them better ones, you know. Lots of food there, easy to come by, lots of ducks and geese. You can go out and throw a subsistence pot out and get crab anytime, and shrimp. I mean, it's easy. Whereas here you work so much, of course, you got a big city nearby. Not that it ain't controlled better, it's just got a big city here and lots of people. Over there you ain't got all that. Lots of game, and you can trap and make a living at it there. If I had a place to start young again, it'd be Kodiak, or further down the chain maybe if I was crab fishing. I followed the construction for a while, and I got mighty quick tired of that and decided on fishing. We got into the fishing, and I followed that, and trapping the winter time, because in the old days, you fished for 5 weeks, and that was it. The rest of it was for yourself, because the canneries closed. They would last 4, 5, 6 weeks that you could sell anything. And then, of course, we salt fish and send them to Seattle. So then it was trap line, fishing the bearing. It'll kill you if you ain't careful. You get lots of adrenaline. I seen two boats go down and kill 9 guys at the same time. I could see one over here and one over there going. Cape Uganek went down inside of Forties Lagoon, blew up and went down. He hit a rock pile and blew up. APA-2 went down about 7-8 miles out in Chillicothe. He couldn't get across. He got caught in the middle. Now he's behind a big reef, bouncing up and down, both of my anchors out and my motor running to keep them joining the crew, you know. Stay there for one day and then calm down, get out again, go fishing. And when you come in at night, you go in the engine room, bring your stuff from topside back up where it belongs, you know. We fished the bearing too for crab. I didn't like that country up there so good.
Why is that?
Rough. Bad country. When you're fishing out there in that district, the guys that you start with, you'll lose at least 5% every year somebody goes. After a while, you're looking, they're all new. You ain't got none of the old timers there. I got lucky and lived through all of it. All of my friends died almost fishing that water, because that's the second roughest water in the world, and the bearing is number one. I figure the Lord was on my side. Give me lots of chances, you know.
That's all for today. Join us again next week for another episode of Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.